There's Wade's report, channel 2 over, and beginning of Wade's report on his trip to New York, and what he found out about the grants this Saturday morning, the 12th of May, 73. Channel 2 over, and the beginning of the visit with Wade, just the two of us, Faye listens in, this Saturday morning, the 12th of May, 73. Channel 2 over, beginning the visit with Wade this Saturday morning, the 12th of May, 73.
Howdy. Judge dismisses all charges. I reckon you got it on TV already. The Ellsberg trial.
Office of Ecological Duke. The Defunct Look magazine, with a specialist who's coming back by Cedric Avenue. Just stated against the war in 2 years, you were one of the millions of Americans who favored the outlawing of insecticides. If you advocated consumerism, if you thought that automobiles should be equipped with seatbelts, if you favored congressional action to clean up the rivers and lakes, if you thought something should be done to clean up the air, if you were pro women's liberation, or you demonstrated against the war in Vietnam, then the man with me, Melvin Grayson, considers you a member of what he calls the Disaster Lobby. I love the cover. The Disaster Lobby, prophets of ecological doom and other absurdities. Mr. Grayson is a co-author of this book. He is a former vice president of the Defunct Look magazine. He was a special assistant to Vice President Spiro Agnew. And he and Thomas R. Shepard, Jr., who was a publisher
Barbara.
Of this book, have written this book. And some of the prophets of ecological doom would be Rachel Ralph Nader, people involved with the ecological or consumerism movement. Obviously, it's an angry book, and it's the kind of book which could make people who read it angry. Mr. Grayson, you called the 60s a decade of the disaster lobby, a time of involuted social ferment, with the good elements sucked under and the bad stuff rising to the top. Could you give us some idea of what good stuff were under and what bad stuff came up?
Well, I think the bad stuff that came up, well, let's start with the good stuff. The good stuff that went under, I think, are the classical beliefs of people. There are biblical concepts of how to live that I think went under in the 60s. But you take things out of the Ten Commandments, as we indicate in the book. Honor thy father and mother, I think, was transmuted into honor by children, because children were, in the 60s, everybody realized children were so
well, let's get into the specifics,
sure.
Because you're talking about the lobbyists and consumerism, and let me, try to add something specific.
I would,
okay.
Because I don't, you said that all the people who supported ecological and consumerism reforms were members of the disaster lobby. I think there's a distinction there. I don't regard them as members of the disaster lobby. I regard them as followers of the disaster lobby.
You would regard them as victims of the disaster.
Yes, I think so. And incidentally, as I point out, as you point out the book, the disaster lobby itself is made of very well-meaning people. I don't regard Ralph Nader or Rachel Carson or any of these other people as evil or conspirators. I think they did what they did out of the conviction that it was essential for benefiting mankind. But I think their problem was twofold. Number one, I don't think they were equipped by training for what they did. And I also think that they had a built-in suspicion of the establishment that I think colored much of what they did. Ralph Nader, for example, I think is a fine lawyer, but I don't think he's equipped to make decisions or air things about, for example, automotive safety. And I think this Corbett incident points that up. He is a man responsible for the destruction or the elimination of the Corvair as an automobile by stating that it had an unusual tendency to roll over. Now, years later, the government put some scientists to work on that, and their conclusion was the Corvair was at least as safe as any other automobile in its field at the time. So this is the
problem. They all would roll over.
I had somebody from Nader's organization call. I was on a show out in San Francisco, and he disputed the figures in the book that air pollution was waning. In other words, quality of air was getting better in city after city based on scientific tests. this man got on there, and he said, I don't believe that. All you have to do is go out in the street and sniff the air. Well, this is the problem with the Nader people. They go out and sniff the air when other people are out there with scientific instruments measuring pollution.
Well, we could, if we wanted to, we could spend this whole period disputing point by point in your scientific facts, and I think you could probably find justification in a great many areas. But you make two sort of general themes running through. One is that most of the disaster lobby hurt big business, made prices go up. You described all of them fairly categorically as left-wing activists who are bad for business, therefore to a degree bad for the country. That's one point. The other is more about the fish and the air and
she's
the water
loaded,
than
isn't
we
she?
Are about man, as this environment is here and man is here. Now, aren't the fish, the air, the water, the environment part of us?
Let me take the 2 points.
Okay.
First of all, I'm not concerned about big business. I think the problem with both of these major movements, consumerism and ecology, is that they hurt the consumer. Now, consumerism to me, paradoxically, is a terrible thing for consumers because it strips the consumer of his basic, biggest, most powerful weapon in the marketplace, which is his determination by his purchases on what is made and sold in this country. If you replace that with some super consumer, such as Ralph Nader or Bess Meyerson or anybody else, then they become the determinant of what is made and sold in this country, which I think it would be terrible for the consumer. So it isn't big business, it's a consumer. Now, yes, you brought up the point on ecology. I think there are areas where man does come into conflict with the animals, and I think this is going. I think the Alaska pipeline situation is a perfect example of that. DDT was. Let's take DDT first. DDT, the critics of DDT say it may hurt certain species of animals, which I'm prepared to admit, although there's very little evidence of it. But the point is that DDT, according to the World Health Organization, has saved 5 million human lives, and without it, thousands of people are dying around the world. And the reason they're without it is because of the scare about DDT.
Right, Compton fella.
She's got that voice quality that's nagging at him.
Yeah, she's
calling him a dog while she's talking to him.
That's right.
Talk.
Did you hear that night then?
Oh yeah. She's pitching right on up there, on the top end of the scale.
Some of the people, they just love them up.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter whether they are for them or against them. They still do that.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Others, they really give them a rough time.
She's biting his heels.
She certainly is. How'd you get loose?
Oh, I finally made up my mind and quit. I ain't meant to be over here at 9 o'clock and 45 minutes late.
Well, you know, this is the first time I turned off the alarm and went back to sleep and got up at 9 o'clock. I thought it was 8. I came down here, you know, and even Saturday, I thought it was Friday.
You lost a day in an hour. That's getting specific.
What'd you do with your brother?
Oh, he's still hanging out over there.
Take half himself?
I hope so. Yeah,
is he as handsome as you?
Oh, he's a character, that guy. He shaves his head.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's got
he goes the other way.
Yeah, he's been doing that for years. When I started, I never did shave mine. I always just cut it once a week with a clipper. And it was the right expedient thing to do. You didn't have to fool with barbers.
Yeah.
Didn't have to comb your hair.
Yeah.
That's what I got in. He was cutting his hair short, and his wife cut my hair. Once or twice when I go through on trucks. And it worked as a whole lot better because when you're carrying out overstuffed chairs, you put them on your head and it messes up your hair.
Yeah.
So it's a good move for a truck driver.
Right. Also, another way of looking at it is, Barbara, you'd have a little padding up there. If you're putting a chair on the top of your head.
Yeah. Yeah, he's going through a great change period. My brother is.
Is he the one that's getting $1.50 an hour?
No, that's my brother-in-law.
Oh, yes, yes.
This one just he lost his job and has applied for a divorce.
Good Lord.
And doesn't have any place to live. And my family's going through some strange periods.
Yes.
I used to be the strange one in the family. Now the rest of them's crazy.
You never have seen that little piece Debbie and Rick did. It's in pretty good shape now. It's still not, no, and not quite in proper shape. They get into so many things. And I haven't seen them in 2 or 3 days. I'm, it bleeds me. It just keeps, it got so damn much energy, you see.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to write a book when they're here. And I guess so I don't have enough energy to read a chapter in the book.
That my brother-in-law thing, that was really funny. That was a good trip I had all around. well, a whole bunch of stories in it, but one nice thing, I got up the next morning after I'd talked to him about till 3 o'clock in the morning, which is a little bit unusual for him. And so I went down to his shop where he's working. And he has a big fuzzy beard now and long hair. And he had an apron, one of the brown aprons with glue all over it, and standing up to his knees in wood shavings, making $2 an hour. He's gotten a raise. And you're talking about somebody that's got developed a hell of a social conscience.
Yeah.
That man's got it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I'm
God,
telling you,
he's
he has got it. He dropped from $20,000 a year to $2 an hour. he's with working men.
Now he's your brother-in-law.
The preacher.
That's not, yeah.
No, that's not my brother that's here. This is the guy. He was a preacher for 20 years.
Yeah.
And doing right smart with the money and everything. You know, they pay for a car and give him a house and a good salary.
Yeah.
And
everything's clear.
Oh, yeah. It's just all slick living, and he's got one of those. You seen those really fine electronic watches with all the gears show? I mean, all the electronic stuff, and really pretty things.
Yeah.
They leave the face off so you can see the mechanism. Christ, they're expensive, $100-something, $200. Well, he's still wearing it. The battery ran down. He doesn't have the money to buy a new battery for it.
So he doesn't wear it without a battery.
Whereas watch. He's got a 750 Honda motorbike. He bought it used for $1,400. Hell, he can't run it because he doesn't have the money to buy insurance for it. It's a great shift for those people. They've got all these things around, you know, like a fine watch and fine Honda machine, and he's working for $2 an hour, and he... My sister is really anxious to get a homestead. Well, now, he's gone all the way back to the old thing that, you remember the old statement, of the public statement, why he mortgaged his house. That meant you was down. When you go to mortgage your house,
yeah.
You're in bad shape. The fellow was really busted when he had to mortgage his house. And that's where he's at right now. He won't go out on a limb for nothing. He's looking at that $2 an hour and figuring how long it'll take him to pay it.
Yeah.
His two older boys make more money by the hour than they drag a chain surveying.
Yeah.
They make $236, $239 or something.
Yeah.
So they're outstripping the old men.
But money. Always that way. Always.
You know, whatever scale you get on.
Yeah. The young start off better than the pappy lines up.
Oh, that was rich. See Joe doing that. And he came, he was sitting at the table, and he pulls off his glasses and said, "See those? So I just got some new glasses." Went down to pick them up, and said, $72. I said, $72? Do you realize that's a whole week's wages for me with these glasses? Starts dressing the man down about charging damn much for glasses. Yeah. And, you know, 2 years ago, it was $72, he'd written out the check and said, "Mine, that's expensive."
Yeah. How about that? You didn't expect to get it, well, you wanted that.
Oh, He's really down there. He's learning it.
Well, what I found out about the preachers, they talk well and all in moralities, but they don't know anything. They don't know anything. Does he know anything?
I think this particular move is going to set him up to understand a few things. That's a very insulated group of people.
Yes.
Preachers. Or they don't have their diapers dry.
The
Lord has taken too good a care of most preachers.
You think they would rebel at the treatment? Yes. They wouldn't want to be that insulated.
Yeah. That's my father's attitude. It was, you know, he was a man of God, and God was the one that's taking care of him all the time.
Yeah.
And anything good, bad, or indifferent didn't belong to him, belonged to God. So he missed the experience.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Just transfer it over.
Yeah.
He essentially didn't have any experience to live on. Which is not too good.
Well, now let me tell you, I never realized that until I've been getting into this stuff out here. And I can see how I managed when I got out of high school and left home. From then on, I got very little experience. And everywhere I went, I was just insulated. I didn't need to get any experience. That's one thing. This stuff is just, I can't get enough of it, you see. It's what I never have done. Well, I've rubbed it and things like that, you see. So I had that in favor of me. But I never, not like these people.
Well, that's the essential thing that's involved in this whole inquiry, what way I'm looking at it. And this is what really struck me hard, particularly sitting at the Ford Foundation in New York. I was speaking Swahili, or whatever you want to call it.
That's what I feel like I'm doing when I go up to office.
Well, I know, but these people got a little more, they're a little closer to it. Hell, they can touch life in a few spots. You get in New York, and you don't touch it anywhere. I mean, you make this money, and it transfers over into all the functions, and that's why that price escalation goes. You just put your dollars down, and you never concern yourself with what's going on. Thing really got me. I was waiting for this man, and here comes this fellow out on the floor, out of the elevator or somewhere, and he had his suitcase. And the receptionist said, you're off again. He says, yep. And got to go to Iowa. She said, you're about to travel this man around here. And it just occurred to me that all he had to do was pick up that suitcase at any moment, call an airline, and get a taxi. And all this stuff was covered, and all his purpose was just to get from here to there. He didn't probably even worry about clothes. Somebody was handling that. And then here I arrived back in Gainesville, and the plumbing's busted, and my clothes are dirty, left my pants in Washington. Then I decided I'm going to fix my car, which was a terrible mistake.
You got in there at that time, didn't you?
Whew, I sure learned how to do that. Next time, I know exactly how. You take it down to GMC place. Tell them to do it. 2.5 days on it. Good God.
I don't know.
But this man... he's not even touching his money. All of his expenses come from somewhere else. On top of that, he's got a good salary, and it's all stabilized for him. So he can move. He doesn't come back to his office and have to fix plumbing.
But he's a traveling man.
Oh yeah, I don't know what he's traveling about. That's not the point. But he's traveling all the time.
Well, give the airline a little business. There's nothing else.
And they do it.
Just cooking.
They do it. Good Lord, I almost missed my plane coming back because Josh was a about an hour and something late, and I knew if I got in there, I was going to be there quite a while. And plane left at 6:40, and I left his office at about 10 minutes till 5.
Long
and
way to go.
And I'd left my suitcase in the locker down at the wrong train station. I mean, the train station is furthest from the airport terminal, so I had to backtrack. And I was in the rushing, and it was a rush hour. And I felt like I was really rushing. And hell fire, man, I was just being left behind. Everybody in New York was going to the plane station running. I said, this is ridiculous. They all can't be in as big a rush as I am, and not everybody's trying to catch one plane out of New York. Millions of people just, boom, going hell-bent for leather.
Yeah, as soon as the bell rang.
Good God almighty, it's frightening. That man, Josh, we spent a good bit of time talking about energy expended living in New York. He doesn't like it. Doesn't like it at all. It really is getting threatening for those people, too.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're dependent on that energy, electricity.
Yeah.
He says, you see these buildings? He says, not a one of them you can open the window in. So they all have to be air-conditioned. And then we get a generator goes out, and just everybody goes crazy in the heat.
Yeah.
Stifling, getting mad, nerves frayed.
Oh, yes.
That's right. That building they're in is a beautiful building, the Ford Foundation. About one of the finest ones in New York. It's sort of a monument. Windows won't open, though. The electricity goes out. The good looks don't help anybody. Yeah, he, I pulled war tactics with him. I did offshore shelling. I sent my bombers over and did it every way I could to sort of get him into the feel of the whole thing. And I got there and talked to him, well, after we got through the Watergate and a few other things, talked to him about, 30-45 minutes about it. He says, I think I know what you're talking about. But that really got me when he said that. And I think I know what you're talking about. But he's a smart enough man that it indicated that he knew what the situation was. He knew it well enough to know that there's nobody in the Ford Foundation that he knew of that could understand it. And he said in the educational wing, so he's in public education, which is primary, secondary. They've got them all compartmentalized. He can't cross over and give anybody a grant to do anthropology. It's out of his field. So, or any sort of thing other than primary, secondary education. And he said, I said, well, what about somebody else in the department? Because this whole fourth floor was all education. Bunch of people. He said, no. He says, you're not going to get anywhere there. They're all economists. He won't know what you're talking about. And he was nonplussed as to how to approach people on this thing, to because he knew what I went through, tried to approach him, and he couldn't see it right off how in the hell we could do it in a smooth manner. I left the egg with him, and he's sitting on it, and he's got this one woman that finally occurred to him right before I left, that he remembered this one person that was she was an anthropologist and might have some sort of a tendency to be interested in something like this.
You know, they tell me, Rambo told me this, and somebody else, he says, told me this. He says, your trouble is you're in the wrong crowd. I'm over there in my department, and there's no contact with this.
I don't know,
guys. I don't know the crowd yet. You see,
that's what I was trying to think. This is something you can't. By God, you can't label it. And everybody, they want a label bad.
Gotta have it.
You got to have some compartment to get into.
Yeah. That's the first thing the fellow told me.
Label it.
Uh-huh. He says you got to have a label so they'll know how to get, so somebody will read it.
Uh-huh. Hell, you can't put Anthropology on it, because Anthropology is just bits and pieces smelling around down at the bottom of it. I mean, that would be, what do you call it, spinoff.
Yeah.
Like we got ceramics out of the space exploration. Space didn't come under ceramics. We've got some fine ceramics out of the space exploration.
I don't know why, but it just came to me the other day. See, I can't, that crowd of students up there, I can't talk to them anymore. I'm just lost complete interest. So, wearisome. So, I'm going to have to retire. I mean, just for my sake.
Self-defense?
I've had enough of it. Well, I don't, I didn't make much chocolate, then I'll be cut out in half of that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it'll be a little better than that because I won't have to taste certain things. But, you know, it just occurred to me, they got money up there. All those departments have access to big sums.
Oh, yeah.
Now, this year, you know, they have a writer in residence, a different one each term, and pay him $10,000 for
each
one
quarter
term.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's nice, but all I mean, it shows they got money available. They can dip their hands in it, you know. I've got a whole lot of this material on Mr. Weaver. I got that in pretty fair shape. I could get a little better shape. But now here's the thing of it, Wade. We started out in such a simple way that the taping was just, we'll buy the tape for you.
Hmm.
Well, you see one little tape there, I may have $500 or $1,000 in it.
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Because I've put in everything out here that I could get a hold of.
Uh-huh.
And that'd be up between $1,500 and $1,000 a year. You say, where'd it go? I can't itemize it. I don't give a damn where it went. You see, it just went. There's so much of it, it's sort of hidden, just little bits. Then I'd go down there and pay the man $25 to adjust something. Well, I could let, they could just take over one of them. Alton said, you all right, why don't you just let them have it? You made your contribution. Just turn them tapes over to them and go on. Well, I haven't seen him turning his tapes over to anybody and going on. He got seniority in the whole family. And on top of that, he writes books and got royalties.
Mm-hmm.
And he'll make as much off as he will while he's here. And he's one of the highest paid men. I don't know what he makes, $20,000 $25,000.
Mm-hmm.
Easy. And here he's telling me just to turn in the chips and go on. And he never turned in anything for nothing. And everything he did on their time.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he's one of my friends. I'm not running him down. I'm just saying that's the way the system works.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why should I give him anything? So they could give me $10,000 for some of this material on Mr. Weaver and sort of underwrite me for a little while. I could work up a little more and they could underwrite me again. They got the money.
Yeah, you got to touch him. Now, well, you talk about like people like Dickie. You got Dickie down here right now.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to have people that like that, except they got people just as good as Dickie here. I don't know why they got
same bloody school they all like. Southern Writers Association or whatever the school is. Ken Warren and that group. That was a fine movie that they put out, Deliverance.
Yeah.
I wouldn't care to read the book.
Yeah.
But the movie was well done.
Yeah.
Strong movie. he's too socially minded, that man.
Well, you see, all those fellas are, they are, they can protect themselves.
Yeah. Well, see, there, that's probably, that English department, to the best of my knowledge, when it gets down to writing and things like that, is shot through too much for these people to be able to accept what you're doing. You're on the other end of the pole. They've got their point in mind before they wake up in the morning.
Yeah.
Inquiry is not one.
No, They're not searching. They construct all around the central point.
You know, I'm just getting to the point now. You say that lay it down. I'm just getting it to the point where it's interesting. Once I get off 4 or 5 chapters, get them in a magazine or publish them myself, I probably have to do nobody publishing for me. I don't give a damn.
I just ran into I've got a manuscript.
Look
go
at
ahead.
All these things. Look at all these things we can do. We can go in there and see how they work.
Yeah.
And you see, these youngsters, the way they write, did you ever think it'd be so simple?
Mm-mm. My brother just gave me a manuscript this man's written on his first chapter on a book about work, labor problem. What he did was get what he called the first chapter, but it's a general concept and some writing going on, and wrote it, put it all together, and Xeroxed it or something, mimeographed it off, and got 50 or 100 copies of this thing. It's probably 25 pages or something, and got the names of a bunch of people, and it's a little introductory thing up in the corner says, this is mailed to you for your comments, and it would be greatly appreciated, and how can we put this thing together? Everybody he knew or could think of would be interested in it, he sent them out a copy and asked for them to send some comment back about how to get this in the right kind of form. I liked his attitude.
Yeah.
I don't know what kind of response he's going to get.
He probably won't get much.
Real fine attitude. Publish his own work like that. Evidently, he was having trouble getting money for it.
Yeah. Well.
But he's got something tangible. He's been working on it a long time. It hasn't been a current problem.
Well, even so.
What you're doing ain't never going to be current.
Well, let me tell you, boy, that's just what you say. You turn these chaps loose out on the field, and you'll see it's current.
It's not going to be a Ralph Nader thing happening.
Yeah.
Everybody's concerned. Well, it might be. You might be right.
It just depends on how you want to push it.
Yeah, yeah. It's a basis of just about anything anybody wants to talk about. What you're into, it's absolutely right. Comes to the mind clear when you're in New York, and the people, you taxi and slam the door, and they're cut off and gone.
Yeah.
Bang, crash, no communication. Never touch anybody, anything.
Well, now that's it. Touch anybody. It's another thing you see is making contact with a person. You see. That's why they all wear this long hair. Why they started out this hippie business, you see. Because they couldn't make contact. And the finest lesson I had in it was from the Spivey boy. You didn't get in on that?
Mm-hmm.
You missed something. He read the Earth magazine. That was his gospel.
Mm-hmm. Whole Earth thing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah.
What?
The Whole Earth or something. Yeah, I know it's magazine.
Well,
yeah.
And it's a good magazine. But, I mean, it's nice. Very nice and done. I've got a copy of it. He let me have 3 or 4, and I kept one. I wouldn't give it back to him. He has such abilities like his all of his family.
Well, David Evelyn did the same. He just said he didn't want to cut his hair off because that was his point of identity right now. His contact point is his long hair.
Yeah. Well, let me tell you, it's just making contact. And I mean there's a point there, but I can't make distinctions. All I can tell is, you see, when they make contact,
maybe that's one of the words that you could use, communication.
Oh, they wouldn't
That's so that's a good word, but it's loaded. It's loaded up so bad from the wrong end.
Yeah.
And this communication thing.
Well, let me tell you. You wait till you see that little thing they did on Wade and the Subculture.
Uh huh.
And they just did that sitting there. And they didn't do it on purpose.
Uh huh.
They didn't do it till I came over here. I picked up the word subculture. And they just went into detail after detail after detail.
Mm-hmm.
It's all perfect in their mind.
Mm-hmm.
It's fabulous how their minds work. Now, I have to go back a minute. I learned that from Suzanne. Suzanne did those two little reports. I showed you them. One on the horse stable, and the other on the restaurant up there.
Lums. I didn't see Lums at all.
Well, maybe you haven't seen them. But that's my cornerstone. What she did on... See, I wouldn't listen to her talk about a horse. Or she didn't know anything about a horse. And they were treating this horse as if he was a pet rabbit or something, you see. They never even rode him. They just feed him.
Better get a chihuahua.
And, going out there every afternoon, you see, and rubbing the horse down. Well, Suzanne understood what it was. She did it kind of, she went along with Jim on it, and he couldn't ride a horse, and he never learned yet. And they took that horse to Texas.
When they moved out there to live?
Yeah. He bought a horse.
Horse van?
Moving in. Yeah. $400 for one. Well, anyhow, but they didn't have space for a tape recorder. I gave her a space recorder. They didn't have space for it, but they had space for that damned horse. Well, anyhow, you see, I'm not too amicable to that horse. So I wouldn't listen. Whenever she started, I said, Suzanne, you don't know it. I'm not going to do all that rubbish. You tell that to somebody else. Well, sir. Started off on that horse stable out there one day, and I thought to myself, she don't know anything about horses, but she knows about all them people out there and what kind of horses they have. And at that stage, you can give them the green light, and she set it down. She never rewrote it. Didn't want it rewritten. I just got it as an exhibit. And what I saw in it, I did the writing on it. I said, they can go where we can't go, and they can see what we can't see. And that was my table. Now the extreme one over there was that thing on Lum. Jim, for some unknown reason, just throw the spoons around, you know, it's nice to have them. Got that job at Lum's, and he held it. You see,
wait, manager or something like that?
Hell
what?
No,
just a waiter type.
He just a dishwasher, a waiter,
making the food. And, yeah,
just $2 an hour, whatever it was, maybe three. And I don't know what happened to him about that time, but Jim let up on his thesis, and the man was leaving for a term or two, and Jim just sat there. That's what happened, and let him get away without Lieutenant Caesar. He had to wait till he come back.
Working lunch.
So he just got a work job alone, but he didn't have to work that way. His daddy gave him money. And they was, at that time, they was living in the house up there in town. Well, Jim has no, I have nothing in common with Jim. He's just a hard-headed bastard, that's all I can see, with no background.
Mm-hmm.
But he's a principal fellow, you know, as long as you go along with him. Well, the way it got to be, I didn't go along with him or anything. He couldn't do anything Suzanne was doing. And here she started talking about Lump one time. And I said, Suzanne, you haven't even been at Lump. How in the hell do you know that? And she laughed, sort of giggled. And she said, Jim told me. Well, I said, now you expect me to believe that. Jim can't report. She said, he can't report. It's just when he's mad and he's mumbling in his beard.
And she picked up all that from that. Huh?
And in her mind, she put it together without intending to.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
She set that down. Now, that's the fact of it, that they don't know about it.
Lord of mercy, I wish, like a lot of these, use the term subculture, a bunch of these kids, all they need is that handle, and they can go ahead right now. They're just sitting on blank.
Yeah.
There's a couple of them that was over there that are basket cases that there's no problem about them. They'll go through life mixed up no matter what happens. Just strange people. But there's a number of people around that I've known and met that would just, they've got everything in their head. They've got these facilities.
Yeah. They've got the gifts.
Yeah, but
they can't use them.
Mm-mm. No, they're pretty dull about a lot of things. Just very dull.
Yeah.
And it doesn't, I don't know, I think it was in a letter I wrote to Josh, something about, I remember like the first or second class with you, and there was a student sitting next to me. I think it was a girl. And about two-thirds away...
Well, you need to get yours.
No, I want to listen.
About two-thirds away through the semester, or whatever it was, I was walking out of class one day, and I just started talking to her. And, I don't know. I can't remember the whole setup. She expressed something. She didn't know what the hell was going on. And I just sort of like... tried to explain to her a little bit what went on, and be damned. She sort of said, well, oh, you know. Then on out, she got into it. It didn't take anything at all. Of course, she was ready, but somebody had to punch her button.
Yeah, that's right.
And after that, she got it and ran off with it.
Yeah.
Doesn't take too much. Same thing happened with Norman on this talk thing. I never said anything direct to him. Next thing you know, here he's coming back bringing me reports. He jumped up and raised hell because somebody was using a condescending interviewing attitude.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He said, just a minute. You know, he was in a committee meeting or something. What do you mean? He was, this sociologist was giving a report on the differences in interviews between on these flood victims, and that their findings were that the uneducated people couldn't give you a decent report on what happened during the flood. It's only educated people. And he put a stop to that.
Picked up this thing. Rick picks him up too. I mean, everything he does is Bastrop.
Mm-hmm.
He's seen more than anybody who's been out here. He's stuck with it longer. Mm-hmm. Debbie, I learn a little bit more from Debbie because she's open and speaks out. But she read this this feature story in the paper about somebody who was 100 years old. And I thought it was in a Tampa paper. It was a Gainesville paper. And she wrote a little piece on it and said what he did. And then she put the article in, and I read it. And I sicked her on the man. I said, he lives on your way home. Just stop and see him. Well, it's he'd just been in the hospital, so there's always always have to postpone things. You can't go ahead and do them while they're hot. While the iron's hot. And she called in though. And she talked to his daughter. See, he's 100, so she must be 75. And young lady.
Young lady.
And Deb said she was negative. She says, are you one of them journalists? Debbie went like it. She was all sour. Says, they just worried my daddy to death. But Debbie speaks so nice, you see. You can't be mean to her. So they got talking a little bit. And this one came out, just on the telephone. She says, my daddy just hates them questions. And that's one thing I found that year. You see, I was up there at the office trying to find a toe. You got two cultures. One of them uses a question and answer method, and the other never do that. They don't ask a direct question. And you know, all my life I've been disturbed by questions. And that's why I quit going to Sunday school. They asked me what I thought about baptism. Well, I said this here in the quarterly, and one of the fellows says, we read the quarterly. Tell us what you think.
They want to pin you down.
And the thing of it was, I didn't think. I had no interest or concern. I had never been concerned with baptism. As far as I could go, they could just ship it down the river. Just forget all about it. As far as I was concerned, you see. But then after that, I still, if I talked about it, I'd have to say what I thought they wanted me to say, you see.
Well, now, or else you'd be written off, for sure.
Oh, yes. Here we picked up your thing there about the sociologist said the educated people could tell him, but the uneducated mm-hmm. couldn't, because they asked questions.
That's right. My brother's got two girls, old brother, and one of them went down over there, maybe she's 13, something of this nature, and doing school projects, and going to do an interview with her grandfather, who's a countryman, and fought in the war, businessman, reasonably well off, and he's a farmer and all this kind of thing. And my brother just right off started talking about how the interview went. The little girl gets in there, she had all prepared. Now, what did you do in the Second World War? And then after he got through that, she'd shift way the hell. She'd been trained into this. This is her interview technique. 13 years old, yes.
Yeah.
Questions, and he'd give an answer. She'd quit right there and give him another question. Evidently, they're teaching it. It's not just accidental. They're instructing you to do it that way. Hell, the same thing in this thing up in Maryland, this project my brother and I got going, a feasibility study was being conducted by a sociologist.
But I find experts don't know such simple things as that, and they don't want to be told.
No.
Go ahead with your...
Well, this is the way I listen to them talk a little bit, and what they're doing, they're supposed to go out amongst the people and interview 30 or 80 people and get their feelings on the subject matter. Hell, I heard my sister-in-law, Kay, just talking to a guy briefly, and I put her down about it later on, and she said, well, I wasn't doing that interview for the job, I was just talking. And all crap. When you talk about it, I said, you took that man from here all the way out to Iowa and left him and then took him back somewhere else and never let him finish one damn thing he was saying. You know, because you just kept pumping him full of questions every time. Hell, he got into something, and he left Washington area and was out in Iowa.
Yeah.
She put him back in one of these halfway houses immediately, and asked him, was his daddy mean to him?
Yeah.
You know, and she said, then she said she was just talking with him. Crap. She was talking with him and said, well, are your parents mean to you? And... no more than he's mumbling around. All he could answer was all this sociological nonsense that he had learned.
Yeah.
You know, every time he'd make a statement, I could take a book, flip through page 93, and underline his answer. That's the only way he could talk. And when he started to open up and something that was outside of that, he just pulled the curtain down and sent him back somewhere else.
Well, now, look here, Wayne. this is what I found. I must have been able to do that at one time, but if I had just known, I mean, my faculties must have worked a little bit at one time. They're bound to have worked a little bit at one time, up until I started reading that medieval Latin. I look at that as my beginning of my downfall. You can't imagine what one paragraph of medieval Latin will do to you. I was trying to read it without a pony, you see.
Uh-huh.
And I'd put the whole morning on that thing. I thought, well, if I just concentrate on it, if I just surround it, if I just pour out energy on it, it'd come to me. You know, it almost blinded me. It got so my eyes wouldn't work. Much less my senses. And after so long a time, never did make any sense of it. I read a little poor translation of it, and I had no idea what the translation said. I did that all summer. You're talking about...
That's a lot of work.
Perseverance is one of the... perseverance has been one of the virtues. It's it's something to kill you. That's perseverance
stuff. You spent 3 hours on the subway getting out there.
Yeah. Well, yeah, but what I was saying, I must have... My faculties must have worked at one time. They can listen like this. They don't have to take notes. They don't have to tape it. They can come home and go to the picture show, and all that rattle rattle in the middle, in between it, and still come back and put it on a typewriter.
Whole bloody thing.
Yes.
I know, there's a couple of guys, there's one fellow in particular, he's crazy as hell, but he can recount still damn near every show he's gone to, you name it, and he gets right into it. He'll live that hell. As a matter of fact, he'll bore you to death. A 2-hour show takes him an hour to tell it. And you got to shut him up, get out of there.
Once you're talking to a sociologist and you get outside that question and answer business, you might as well be talking to Kathy out here.
Yeah, those sociologists work just like that Penn Warren writing school. They've got their opinions first, and they're going to put clothes on it or something.
Yeah.
Background, that's, don't want it to come out.
And you see, I'm not in competition with them. And so whatever they do, I can look at. And in the classes, they're in competition with each other. And nothing much ever comes out in those classes. They won't let each other perform. What they do, they have to do on the side, on paper. They can't perform. Well, anyhow, that's another side of it.
I've mentioned to you this. I don't know why I hadn't gone over and contacted this man. It would be another, if we could get him moving on it. This is this Taylor Scott in the religion department.
Yeah.
And he has a tendency to be pedantic. I think he could be washed out of it a little bit. I mean, he wants to get out of it. But I think he'd have a basis of understanding this, and I might be able to pick up some help somewhere. I just look at anybody that can get interested in the thing as being able to start supporting them. The point that I'm trying to get with this Josh Smith up there in New York is that if we get something hot going anywhere else, get a letter from Josh Smith, Ford Foundation paper, saying, just find a bunch of chaps. That's all he's got to say.
Yeah.
And people, they'll look at that letter harder than they would at what you're saying.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Letterhead.
Yeah.
Damn letterhead. What they're interested in. Credentials.
You see, I haven't worked on the countryside since 15th of August in 71. I just, at that time, I figured I had to surface. I didn't know I was going to leave the countryside, but I'm not in contact at all with the countryside anymore. I work with these flatheads. And it's fabulous what they can do. It's fabulous. I don't think. Now, just the out and out faculty, you see. You see, it's up here at the office. They figure they know all these things. They know. They work with these brilliant people. They know all that. You can't tell them anything. If you start telling them something, they'll look at you just like they just swallowed a frog. But I sure didn't know it. The only thing that gets me down now is that MLA stuff I'm trying to do at the desk. I've got to get 4 or 5 chapters away. I simply have to do it to float anything else.
The second outline that you gave me, some of the papers you gave me had 10 chapters that were just like this, and then you went into, it was about 3 chapters, 1, 2, 3, with a heavier outline, and that was getting toward it. And if you can get a little bit stronger than that, with just good heavy outlines with 1 chapter written, that's the brick. That's the building base. And that begins to...
You think so?
That adds up. That's a strong thing. I don't care what else goes on. That's people love. I mean, it's a good thing. I'm not going to put the book down by saying that people love it if you've got the damn thing outlined and show that you know what you're going to do. They want that written down there, and it's something you can put your feet on.
Well, I didn't realize that. Let me tell you, I've got the chapter written in there. It's rough, but I can get in shape. The only thing is, you need a little bit of the theoretical side of it. A little bit of it. But anyhow, on this Shropshire ad, I think that's one of the most telling things. You see, along there, that it's see, we got started out here, I did, in 68, fall. Barbara's here in the fall of 69, and that was the first time things really moved. I mean, things were going. You had sideshows.
Mm-hmm.
Cookie had come, and by the fall, he was in it, in on it, with all the little cookies. And he underwrote me there for 2 or 3 years. He didn't realize how much he did. I don't guess he does. But it seemed like every time somebody come out here, the little cookies would be here. And Cookie and Helen. And I'm telling you, they are rich. All of them. Well, but it was Jim Means I had in mind. You see, Jim Means came up in this whole country. It was his country. He can come over here now and tell me what the ground is in each one of these pastures, where
mm-hmm.
it's flaky and what. And he knows watermelons, and he knows citrus, and he was brought up on sweet potatoes, you see, him and Miss Bootsy. And he just talked as if he, you see, I have no time for it. He is a pauper, a poor man, but he knows everything, and he knows everybody, and the country is just inside of him. He has a proprietary interest in it, you see. I've got no time for it. And I thought, well, this Shropshire Land, Houseman wrote. Houseman knew the Shropshire Land. Maybe I can get it from Houseman. So I picked up my old copy of it. I always read a few little stanzas. I never knew the whole thing. I just went through it, you know, how you'll do, and
mm-hmm.
some things will sort of make contact with. And some of them. And it threw me. I couldn't get into it. Everything I read was he going down on the scaffold hanging it with a noose around his neck. Great deal of that in it. Well, Alphonse Morris, one of the PhDs, wrote a thesis with him on the Shropshire Land. I didn't know it until I had seen it advertised, published for the Tennessee, you know, University of Tennessee Press. And I wrote for it at first rate.
Hmm.
And I didn't know then, until later, that he had done it under Alton. I worked through that, and he knows what, how it hangs together. But it's just fabulous what a background you have to have in order to read a little set of poems like that. So that's one of my points. They use the major forms up there that students can't reach. And they make a point of using the masterpieces until I went from the major forms then to the minor forms. What I use out here would be the minor forms. The students can see them and also use them. But I could find no evidence. It's perfectly clear in there. Houseman never saw a Shropshire Lad. He lived in a different county and overlooked Shropshire, and he could just see the hills over there. He didn't know any lads. He was classics professor in London most of his time until he went to Cambridge, wherever he went. And he didn't know any Shropshire lads. So the whole thing is literary. Holy literary! Holy! And a few newspapers. So what I do
completely,
I put down that I for that chapter I put down Mr. Weaver and the Shropshire Land. And I put on Mr. Weaver and put on some of the things that he talked about. And Mr. Weaver was born the year the Shropshire Lad was published, 1894. Mm-hmm. Well, it's not quite crickets, you see. The reverse must have the things change a little bit. But it's also different. There's no hanging in Mr. Weaver. And there's no bitterness, and there's none of that. Everything he says is really sad. It's all worked out. Well, I said to Alton, you know, this will be fine. Maybe this fellow will do it for me. I won't have to do it. I'll give him my stuff on Mr. Weaver, and then he can write it on Hausman. That he didn't know his name, totally literary. And it don't work out in practice. And Alton looks like he swallowed a frog.
Messing with Union now. Going around Union busting, guy. Knocking out the feather bed.
Well, I told Alton that I didn't really intend to use it. but I said this with a little sarcasm. You see, do you suppose Hausman would object to me using the shop chalet? And I said,
lay claim to that
too. So you ought to see some of the beautiful things Mr. Weaver says.
Uh-huh.
They're beautiful things. He's got no relation at all to that Shropshire lad. And here in the fall of 69, I was trying to get some help from Shropshire. Well, it didn't throw me. I'm used to it. I've been thrown so much. I get up pretty easy.
I don't know which is a chicken and egg situation. It reminds me of going by to see my younger brother in 62.
Let me tell you, you can read this book. It's readable. And he's a good writer. He's a good...
This is a PhD you're talking
about.
Yeah,
PhD man.
He's got a whole book on the Shropshire Lad.
Well, it's not a very big book. But it's readable.
Okay.
It's all literary. You see, all the literary people now, they don't talk about the content of what the man says. They talk about how he says it. It's all on literature, not on the what literature says. It would be condescending, you see, to talk about what it says.
Yes, I sort of look at it as jargonese they develop. Insulate.
So I just took the... Fortunately, there was a new edition, same one, Avon edition, or Avon edition of it that I used, and Avon had a new edition, and it was annotated with a poem on one page and on the other page notes on it. Well, they were pretty sad notes. But it's enough for the footnotes, for me to footnote it. See, if I wanted to say something, I'd just refer to a page. And like Fanny was here one time, she wanted to talk about Matthew. She said she didn't know much about Matthew. I said, Fanny, you got to the point where you don't have to know anything about Matthew. You just say what you want to say and call it Matthew.
Yeah, right. Call it Matthew. Well, that's damn true. Well, I got Billy Graham's authorized edition of the Bible, and I said, by God, I'm going to put out my own. He's got his own version. It's published. Mother sent it. His own blasted version of the Bible, authorized by Billy Graham.
Yeah.
Now, Fanny can be Matthew for sure. That's just part of it.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing. This I was right interested in a thesis this guy Valdemar Novikov put out in one of his books that was so thought to be a pretty banned book or something, but he had a good thesis, and I'd read it a number of years ago, and I was just considering the thesis, and then something came out in Saturday Review, and his name was on the cover, and I said, well, good, I'll read what's going on with this man. Good Christ, guy, he was terrible, just terrible. I read three paragraphs and threw it down.
Yeah.
It's amazing. That's absolutely amazing. I mean, there's nothing wrong with his thesis and what he's working through. But when he opened his mouth and spoke personally, I've forgotten how the book was written because I wasn't concerned with it at that time. But when he opened his mouth and started talking personally, he's not there. And it gets so, you just have to put these people away.
Yeah.
When I was writing about this talk stuff, I was pointing out that it could ruin your reading habits because you find out if the guy wasn't talking straight, you'd put him down in the book. You just leave him alone. Just like when you get in a conversation with somebody and they can't talk. You leave
him. You know, most of my time, I didn't know how to put him down, put it down. I keep laboring on it to see what he meant. And I figured there's something there. I just couldn't get it.
Yeah, you call yourself stupid, don't you? Can't get it. They know something I don't know.
I mean, you've got to be way along before you can look at this thing and say, hell, he don't know nothing. Yeah. And so does I. You've got to be way along. I'm telling you, most of my time I've been trying to, you see, make something out of a Sunday school lesson when there wasn't anything in it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to throw up on the Sunday school.
Good Lord. Yeah, that's. I was trying to bring this thing about and talking somehow, writing these people, and it's really hard to do. You hate to get too blustery about things, but
yeah.
this concept affects your life. Is the difference? I mean, it's not academic. It's not like going out and. Well, it's not like learning chess, you know, or pursuing something of that nature. It permeates your life. Debbie, when she was over there talking the other day, she said, I've been here 4 months. She says, good God, things are just different. I look at things differently. And in other words, it's, I don't know, I don't want to talk about it too much because you start labeling things. and you get a little bit too strong about it
that's
being
right.
Changing people's lives, and you get to be preaching about it, and
yeah.
that ruins it.
Right.
But that's damn sure in there.
Yeah.
And that economy thing is quite interesting. Like it can make your life much more economical.
Yeah.
Like you can pick up that book and you say, well, it's a bunch of crap. You can put it down and don't worry with it.
Yeah.
Because the man has exposed himself immediately in three sentences.
Yeah. Yeah.
He'll expose himself.
I used to think, well, they're pretty good. They get in print. And, you know, I saw case after case about people that I knew, and I knew they didn't know a damn thing, who got in print steady. And I don't know. I never did rationalize it or articulate it, but... you know, you get to the point where the editor's got to print something. And most of that stuff they print, it's from their contacts.
Mm-hmm.
It's not from unknown people.
Oh, you hear people, my publisher, the man says.
Yeah.
He owns a publisher.
Well, I don't know. That's outside my experience. But just the long and short of it is, a whole lot of it, you struggle with it. And there's not anything there much to get. I used that several years ago before I got into this. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
I had found that out. And I had found out, you see, that even the students had adapted themselves to that in a most peculiar way. If they could read a book and it came out to them, they were condescending toward it.
Hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
wanted to read something that caused them trouble.
Mm-hmm. figured they weren't learning anything.
Yeah.
Didn't exercise them.
Yeah. I found that by using Dale Carnegie.
Yeah.
Now Dale Carnegie, in spite of all of them, he's not condescending. He's good. And he has a great deal to say. But they can understand it. And you know, they just didn't throw it down. They slammed it down. They were rash about it. Why, here this feller at the University of Florida get me to read this.
You know, I don't think this guy Bob Sharp was in your class.
Yes, he was.
He was? Yes. You remember him then, if he was in your class. And we were sitting at the back of the room in one class, and I've forgotten where we got him.
I can see both of you right there now.
And he had Eric Hoffer.
Yeah.
And I heard a commotion going on. I hooked friends. What the hell are you doing, Bob? And he was ripping the book off page by page. He had put it down. He ripped it up, page by page. Big pile of pages on the floor. Oh. I'll never forget that scene. Oh,
I'm sorry we couldn't keep in touch with that goon.
Oh, I lost him. I heard from him once or twice since.
He was a spirit.
He was. My God, he went off down to Cuba and worked for the Cuban government, got into all kinds of trash with his international business.
Well, I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and he was working for the Cuban government over here in the United States. And be damned, the last time I saw him, you know what he was doing? He was writing a letter to the President of the United States offering his services. Eric Hoffer, that's why he didn't care what he was into. It didn't make a lick of difference to him. Not a bit.
Yeah.
He'd just do anything. Cuba dropped him, I imagine. He's looking for a cause. That was something. Yeah, Eric Hoffer is too direct.
Well, you know, it's a funny thing. I couldn't read Eric Hoffer then. And I've got into Eric Hoffer. He's been one of my guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into him in the most peculiar way. It's almost like just being constantly fed to you. And I finally got so I could see what he did. He's a very poor writer. He says he's a poor writer. And the New Yorker profile on him is written so well and handles the material with such ease, and Hoffer just stiff. He can talk. Now, that New Yorker couldn't talk like Hoffer, and I saw him talking here. You see, in that True Believer, he uses a thesis just like I do.
Mm-hmm.
That talk is informative,
mm-hmm.
and the content is experience. Now, you may lose track of that, but I never do. I didn't exactly realize it all the time. He does the same thing. The autochthonous man, the autonomous man, the free, autonomous individual, scared to death. There's too much on him. He'd much rather have equality than freedom. And he goes from one statement to another, you see. this basic statement he makes opens up all the fields. You go into the colonies and you see the colonials. They're not ready for freedom. The Russians go in there and give them something to hang on to. Other Americans go in there and make them free, autonomous individuals and scare them to death. And it don't matter what to hang on. Just anything. That's what he says about the true believer. It don't matter what the belief is.
Right.
Yeah, and furthermore, the more irrational it is, almost. Well, now you see how long it took me to get that. And you see, the people I've talked to have never got it. And the basic thing here, this is the thing that Debbie picked up, is that she had read a lot of books, but then she discards them. She don't use them.
Mm-hmm.
She don't know how to use them. She said it never had come to her attention. She's supposed to use a book.
Yeah, it's sufficient to say, oh yes, I read that book. And
she reads it and stands it, and she makes an A or A plus and everything. Well, you wouldn't have to grade her. Just her attitude towards.
Yeah. She still got it too.
Yeah, she still got it.
She's beautiful. She's really beautiful. She keeps that attitude, and all this other stuff's working underneath it. It's nice.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
I don't know how much duplicity she'll take on. I think you have to have some to survive. You can't seem to be what you are. You got to be what the Sunday school caller says. You got to be what they expect you to be.
Well, she might be fortunate.
She might be.
Because she's got a well-developed person.
Yeah.
And she's not concerned about modifying that at all. But she knows she's underneath. She's doing these other things.
Yeah.
As, exterior, they stay the same.
If she can just keep that, I tell them I don't want to change them. I don't want them to go home and examine their friends or their family like that, or try to proselyte or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You go home and you talk to your friend like you always did. If you don't, you won't have any thing to hang on to.
Yeah.
There won't be anything to hang on to. And it's a whole lot better to have a few friends than it is to proselyte. A few.
Yeah, some of them, it comes a time when some of that stuff will leak out. Most of them, it doesn't. Everyday friends, you can't. I try never to mention stuff to them. It belongs to me.
Once you get ahead of them, then you got to talk in that term.
Mm-hmm.
Once you get ahead of them, and it's no trouble. I mean, it's just what you have to do. I can generally do it, but then one time out of 10 I don't do it, and then that kills
me. That blows you. Well, I don't know what the next step is exactly. How close are you to getting something that's real? Those chapter outlines are good. And they need to be somewhat fat, and if you've got a good introductory chapter or beginning chapter. That, and what we ought to do is get a cassette built. I can get Santa Fe has a copy machine. It'll copy four cassettes at one time and do it just like that. It does it high speed.
Is that all it'll copy?
At one time.
Well, it won't copy reels?
I don't know. It should do reels.
Telephone. Happens to do reels.
Okay.
So that's what I need now.
Well, I'm just talking about for the...
I'm talking about the other.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about trying to put a package together that we can get some money for.
Yeah, I understand.
You need these specific things.
Yeah.
You need a really good, clean, straightforward tape. Now, I hadn't analyzed the one you gave. Oh, hell, I should have brought it back today. That was nice. My brother had it all set up. He went and used government equipment. He had the cassette, ran it off, copied it, and it worked because I left the cassette with him.
Yeah.
I wasn't positive whether that was a copy or original tape. I didn't get it straight with you, and I was worried about losing it or leaving it. That one tape.
I never let out original.
Okay.
I mean the last copy.
Well, so what? See, the cassette is a popular machine.
Yeah.
And most offices have some availability of a cassette machine. And
yeah.
These reel-to-reels are not common. So you can get this package together with these concrete items in it. And this man, Josh, said, one thing is that the tax law in 69 has forced these institutions to foundations to begin to give away a great deal of money. I've forgotten what the term period ending would be. But tax law change has come into effect in 69, which is forcing them to have to get rid of money, and a lot of them don't know what the hell to do with it. There are some 20,000 foundations, and he said a number of these, there's family foundations, there's one person that makes one decision about who gets the money and why.
Yeah.
And you just never can tell.
We need to work through somebody in a foundation. You don't think that'd help any more than what we've got here?
Well, you got this Pat Rambeau, and she's theoretically supposed to know things. And Josh Smith, good God, you think if anybody would know, he would know. He said the Ford Foundation employs 25% of the people that have anything to do with foundations.
That's that big.
That's the biggest one. I'm going to write him a letter to hopefully get up there Monday or Tuesday. Just recontact letter. And every time I can find the slightest bit of excuse, write him another letter. If I've got a good solid question that he can give an answer to without a great deal of effort, I'll ask him. Just keep the pipeline open.
Yeah.
Now, you've got that big grant book, that monster grant book. I don't know whether Rambeau could help or who could point out the direction to take in that. He said it's listed by states or state foundations, you know, like all of them that are in Florida.
Yeah.
You might tailor the approach to one way or the other.
Yeah.
I was thinking about trying to get a package together that all you have to do is write a small cover letter that directs it to the institution or whatever, or the person, if you know their name, put it together, and the package doesn't cost you maybe $2.
Yeah.
And you get a cheap tape. You know, you don't need these $3 cassettes. You can just get a $1.39 and buy into that. But it needs to be set up so it's as clear as possible to the people, because it's much. I didn't get to listen to the tape with Josh Smith. Wasn't any time for that. And I assumed that would be the way it was anyhow. And if he does listen to it, or when, it's a bit of skepticism. I'd much prefer to be there to just be in presence while the tape's going on. Nothing else. Make him pay attention to it. You know, when you're off by yourself listening to that tape, you have to go flying off somewhere.
Yeah.
But if you've
got
all you need is another person sitting there, and it's sort of like the TV. You can't go moving off too easily. So that's the problem. But he felt an importance in that tape. He wanted it. He wanted that tangible thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah. He asked for it. He wanted the tape. He wanted something that was representative of the work.
Oh, really?
That's the reason I think the chapters, chapter outline.
Oh, Lord. Well, that's just the thing I've been shying away from.
I think probably we can stop and do away with everything else if you've got two or three items like that and say you just want to finish the work.
Yeah.
Or something that is as clear as that. And I've got tried these definitions, and I think maybe some cleaning up of that might work. Just define what your terms, what you're talking about, in two, three pages. And here's what has been done. Here's the concrete evidence. Here's what's needed.
Yeah.
And I think you can spend all day making it complicated, and the people will either understand it or they won't, Guy. That's about the way it goes.
Yeah.
They'll get a glimpse of it and feel like it's an important thing and want to talk to you further, or if they don't see it from a little bit of exposure, Christ, you can talk to them for a year.
That's it.
Not going to do a bit of good.
No, that's start educating people.
Sure. I mean, you're doing... Like I mentioned it to Josh, that I said, hell, I'm trying to write the grant proposal and got in just worrying with it a little bit and realized that that'd be a third of the work that you want to get the money for is to get the proposal in order.
Yeah.
I mean, that got right into an exploration right off, you know, just, and that's, it needs to be done. That's fine. But God almighty, that's a lot of work.
A lot of work. Everybody applies for a grant, look how much work goes into it. Now, Norman read that little, those little things that I put into the grant with Chris.
Mm-hmm. He was impressed, but his question was, he didn't know whether he was impressed because I'd opened him up a little bit,
yeah,
or whether it actually was clear.
Yeah.
So he couldn't give an authentic, he's a very straightforward person. I told him that he's a little weird too, so he might have an. I mean, like he's very different from other people.
Yeah.
He suggested that we get a few of those and spread them around cold and get a response on it.
Norman.
Yeah. In other words, pick out somebody that you know, but you've never ever talked to concerning this inquiry, and just say, read that, and come back a few days later and say, well, what about it? See, just to see what the exposure is on that.
Yeah.
Hard to tell.
Now that's the type of writing that I've been developing out here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
See, it's not MLA stuff. There's no jargon in it. It's about as easy as the language will go.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing that for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And even Florence said one time, I wrote a letter to Ed up here. She says she read it and says it doesn't seem like writing. And it's just like, don't it? Well, anyhow, that's not what it. But the thing of it is, these chaps can do it. You can get an easy, clear touch. It'll hold all the information. It lacks a whole more information than this sociological jargon.
Oh, hell yes. No problem about that.
I learned that from Ms. Rawlins. There's so much more information in Cross Creek than I ever dreamed was there. It's really informative, except it doesn't oppress you so you don't think there's any information there to speak of. Several people up the office read those little things.
They did.
And you know, not one of them spoke of that. All of them says, this won't get you anywhere.
Okay, that's the thesis that I took off from. You're in the case of these institutions too, these foundations, I'm fearful that you're going to be dealing with the same quality of people that you turn these over to.
Yeah.
They want this cover stuff, this, MLA language, to prove that you are an intelligent person because they read what you're writing and they say that man's not educated. He can't handle this. You're doing what you're talking about. You're carrying it out in that language. But immediately it sets up that condescending attitude on their part. Right immediately. You need a paragraph with 12 big words in it. Start them off.
that band that you found.
Mm-hmm.
He took it over to Eddie, and Eddie put it up on the rack and looked at it. And he didn't tell the boy, but he told me afterwards. He says the boy wasn't telling the truth about anything about it. He says the thing was beat up, and it had vicious